So I feel like a bit of a fraud. My background is in the design of compilers and programming languages and microprocessors. So when I was fortunate enough to move fields into this kind of area, I was sort of fishing around for ideas that would enable me to kind of link what I did know about to what I didn't know about. So if you're writing grant proposals, you call this interdisciplinary research, but really this is kind of just a sort of self-preservation, right? So I wanted to keep my job by finding something I could usefully do. So the idea of using compilers and compilation techniques, really, more generally in cryptography, is something that interested me. And I've been able to sort of revisit that over the last year or so. And so the talk today is sort of loosely on a few different aspects of that in the context of elliptic curves. So basically, the motivating thing about this is that most people are going to when they're asked to implement some sort of cryptographic primitive or a protocol or something, they'll sit down and they'll use something like C to do this. So when I say C, usually I mean a C-like language, so maybe they use C++ or something like this. But generally speaking, they're going to use a general purpose programming language to do what they want to do, which is, you know, this is a reasonable approach, I suppose. C's as good a language as any. It's going to, when it's compiled properly, it's going to give you good performance. It allows you to sort of perform all the things you want to, but essentially all the work's being done by the programmer, because C is a general purpose language. It doesn't really know about cryptography, doesn't know about the types involved or anything like that. So because it's general purpose, it's not really working enough for us. And what I'd like to do is I like to do less work, essentially. I'm pretty lazy, so I'd like my compiler to help me out in some sense whenever I do some implementation. So I like to make the distinction here between sort of security-aware compilers and cryptography-aware compilers. So when I'm talking about security-aware compilers, really I mean things like, you know, C compilers can already do a fairly limited set of operations on the programs you feed them. They can kind of instrument buffer overflow protection and detection mechanisms, for example. So I'm going to try and shy away from that sort of side of things and focus on the sorts of compilers that you might use to implement elliptic curve cryptography. And in this context, then C makes it kind of difficult, or at least less easy, to write these programs. The first reason is because, well, C doesn't include a first-class type for finite fields, for example. It doesn't know what a finite field is. It doesn't really understand what the optimizations you might do using operations on variables of that type. So whereas it does know about 32-bit integers, for example, and it might sort of help you out writing programs using that sort of type, it can't do the same thing using finite fields. You're stuck using a library where the sort of the meaning is lost. The second thing is that you can sort of write all your low-level primitives usually, but when it comes to writing a protocol, maybe you want to actually switch to a different system. Suddenly you're talking about communication, you're talking about some processes communicating with each other and channels between them. C doesn't let you capture that very in a natural way, I would train. You can do it clearly, but it's not a very natural way of writing down programs like that. So, yeah, C compilers can't help you produce high-performance implementations, or at least they're not doing as much work as they can do in that respect. And the final thing here is they can't really do anything about detecting security problems. So whereas you might expect your C compiler to help you out detecting functional problems with your program, maybe it can detect type mismatches in your program, for example. These are functional problems. It can't really do anything about detecting that you don't check the padding in your public key padding system or something along those lines, because essentially the meaning or the semantics that are associated with those have been lost because you can't actually express them in your programming language. So the aim really is to sort of try and develop a language and a compiler to sort of alleviate some of these problems. And just to sort of try and prove that this isn't a kind of one-man crusade, there's been a number of other projects. This isn't meant to be an exhaustive list of those necessarily, but these two systems here represent two compiler or language projects that sort of take a similar kind of approach. So the first one, this SIMAP system, is developed by a group led by Eden Damgaard. And the idea here is that you express your multi-party computation as a sort of C-like program, and then the compiler is able to compile this down and produce an executable for you. So, you know, in some sense, the compiler knows about multi-party computation and all the kind of associated protocols and things like this that go on and enable you to do it. So, you know, if you think back to the Rumpf session talk last night, multi-party computation is only regarded as marginally humorous on the well-known cryptological scale of hilarity. So this is a serious problem, and if they were to, you know, they're doing some good work, if they're able to actually to solve this, then, you know, people can hopefully execute their multi-party computations rather than just write papers on them. So maybe, you know, somebody somewhere wants to sit down and work out who earns the most without actually disclosing their salary or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, so SIMAP is an example of this, really just, they focus mainly on multi-party computation, but essentially the ideas involved are exactly the same. And the Coda is a similar sort of system. This is a project by the group led by Stefan Lux. So similar sort of idea, but whereas SIMAP will sort of try and force you to write a program that is secure, Lacoda actually aims to be a bit more general and allows you to write all sorts of different programs and then sort of does some analysis based on that. So there's lots of other systems that and related topics, I suppose. You can go into the topics of theorem proving, automatic theorem proving, automatic security proofs and these sorts of things. They're all kind of in a similar area. But yeah, it's fair to say there's an increasing interest in this. So we've kind of done a similar thing and maybe focused on slightly different areas, I would say. So our language is called CAU. This is a kind of an amalgamation between C and a language called OCaml. OCaml is based on CSP, so you have a number of communicating sequential processes and they communicate with each other by channels. So you can sort of think of these as parties in your protocol, if you like. And then the sort of C part of it enables you to write those parties in a way that is able to produce a sort of efficient implementation of them. So the OCaml part gives you the communication, and the C part gives you the ability to actually produce high-performance results, hopefully. So there's sort of three or four main aspects to this that maybe are in addition to other C-type languages, for example. So the first thing is obvious, we try and extend the set of types that that you can use in the language and the compiler actually knows about. So big integers and finite fields and things are sort of first-class objects in the language, whereas they wouldn't be otherwise. And operations on these things are first-class as well. The second thing is that we allow this sort of attribute mechanism as a form of markup to the program. So the idea here is that you're able to express the sort of security semantics, for example, of your program to the compiler, so the compiler can then use those in doing some analysis or making decisions about how it generates code and so on. So, yeah, I mean, you could argue, I suppose, that you could do this with a C compiler to a certain extent, but this, again, is a sort of first-class feature of the language rather than just some sort of hack that's been added on afterwards. And then finally, the idea that, first of all, you can write one program sort of generate lots of different things from that one program. But finally, the most important thing, really, from my point of view, is the idea of being able to analyze the program for aspects of physical security. So ideas like side channel analysis, you know, you don't get any help for that if you're implementing programs. We'd like a system where you at least get some sort of idea about problems that might exist, even if it's a fairly naive first approach. This seems like an ideal, it seems like a good idea to give people help, if not a perfect solution. So the actual the system kind of looks like this, and our idea really is to use compilation techniques in two different directions. So the idea is that you should be able to start off with a CAU program, run this through a compiler which is sort of composed of fairly standard phases. So the front end kind of parses the language and converts this into an intermediate form, which is ideal for the compiler to do some optimization and things on. And then the back end is specific to a particular target. This is the thing that generates the actual target executable that you're going to run on your target platform. So this sort of flow along the top here is pretty similar to what a normal compiler would do, except that we've got these extra aspects in there, so the compiler is sort of aware of the cryptography we're doing rather than not aware of it. The second direction is from this arrow here, basically. So the idea really is to start off with a generic library of primitives that kind of implement our non-native types. So this is going to be our implementation of finite field arithmetic, for example, and this is going to get translated somehow to a runtime library, and that's sort of the first main part of the talk is why would you want to do this, and how well does it perform? So I wouldn't want to try and claim that there's anything clever going on here. These are pretty much all known compiler techniques. It's a fairly standard structure for everything. The idea is that it's just going to give us a big help over what's currently available. So, well, I suppose, the only formula in the whole talk. Maybe that's a good thing for the first talk after lunch. So it's meant to relate to elliptic curve cryptography somehow, and I'm going to focus on binary curves over binary finite fields just for the sake of a sort of consistent example. There's no real reason why you would necessarily do that over any other. So, yeah, the outline then really is there's three main things I'm going to talk about fairly briefly. The first thing is how we've used compiler and specialization techniques to generate, to sort of take this step here. We start with a generic library and specialize our library towards an actual runtime based on what goes on in here. So if I say I'm using a particular finite field, I take my generic source code for that, and I specialize it into something that's particular to this, to what I'm using in my actual program. The second thing is, well, how can I make my what happens when I make my language more expressive in terms of the types and operations I'm going to do? Yeah, that's fairly straightforward, really. And then finally, I think something that's fairly interesting is the idea that, how do you trust what the compiler is actually doing? This is meant to help us out in some way in implementing cryptography. How do I actually trust that it's not going to do something stupid and really kind of ruin all the benefits that I'm hoping for? So Roberto Vanzi's got a paper about implementing hyperelliptic curve cryptography. I think this was at CHES a few years ago. There's a nice statement in here which kind of sums up briefly exactly the problem we're trying to attack by taking this step between the generic library and the specialized runtime. So he says that all general purpose software libraries introduce these fixed overheads. So, well, kind of to an expert programmer, this is a kind of obvious statement, because if you're implementing your arithmetic over a binary field, addition, for example, is just an XOR. So if you've got kind of, I don't know, n words or something, you need to XOR these all together. You write a loop from I is naught up to n minus 1 or whatever. You XOR them together, and that's great. So you've got a function to do your field addition. But of course, the XOR operation itself, maybe I should just show you an example instead. So this is the sort of generic code at the top here. At the bottom here is really what we want to get towards, because the problem is you've got this overhead of actually implementing operating the loop itself. Every time I ran the loop, I've got to increment my loop counter. I've got to do a comparison, and in a pipeline process, it's going to cost you even more. Basically, the crux of it is I shouldn't really have the loop there at all, because I kind of for a particular field, I know what n is, and this cost is just going to kill me. So like I say, for an expert programmer, this is probably an obvious statement. All they do is say, well, okay, I'll just turn this into a macro, or I'll inline my function, I'll write a special reduction operation, or I'll look up in my elliptic curve book, and for a particular field, I've got a special reduction operation instead of a general one. I just basically, by hand, specialize all my code towards a particular field I'm using. But if you look at it from a software engineering point of view, it's kind of difficult. First of all, it's pretty well, okay, maybe there's just a few fields you use in practice, but just let's assume that you can pretty much use whatever fields you want and whatever curves you want. This is going to be pretty labour intensive to go away and do the specialisation by hand for every particular set of parameters you've got. You know, I don't like doing any more work than I have to, so it makes sense really if I was to be able to do this automatically, if I didn't have to pay a price for doing so. That would reduce my error, so I'm more productive. The second important thing really is that maybe doing this optimization early on, hinders portability, I've written there, probably that's the wrong word, probably hinders maintainability in the sense that as soon as I've made that optimization, I've kind of made it relative to an assumption about what the platform is I'm running the code on. So if I've got a platform where I've got an actual some hardware support or some instruction set extension that enables me to do the field arithmetic, maybe I didn't want to do that optimization after all. Maybe I should have just left it as it is and it would have panned out okay. So doing this optimization early isn't necessarily a good idea if you've got to port the code to a lot of different places. So what we'd really like is a best of both worlds situation. We'd like to take a generic field library and automatically transform it into something for a particular set of parameters. And this is a technique well known in compiler circles, so this is the idea of specialization or partial evaluation. So what we wanted to do is actually just do some quick experiments to prove that you could do this. So we wrote some code, some generic code for binary field arithmetic for any n and any sort of any field polynomial. So, you know, we sort of just take the standard algorithms from your favourite book on elliptic curve cryptography and implement those. I suppose that the one that's slightly different to what you might use it in reality is this idea where the reduction function is generic. So all you do is feed this reduction function the field polynomial and so maybe some pre-computed stuff to do with that polynomial, but otherwise it's totally generic. So this would be a bad idea, I would imagine, in terms of performance. But, you know, it works for any field, so that's not too bad. And then we did what you would normally do by hand. We took this and specialised it by hand. We inlined all the functions, unrolled all the loops and so on. We wrote these specialised reduction functions that you take out of your book or whatever. And then you end up with something that you hope is going to run a lot faster because suddenly it hasn't got all these fixed overheads associated with everything. So what we wanted to compare was this hand-specialized code with something that we produced automatically. And what we used to produce that automatically is a system called Tempo. So Tempo is a kind of state-of-the-art is maybe overplaying things a bit because it's a little bit old now. But essentially it's a system that takes C code and enables you to produce specialized functions based on what they call an execution context. So you give Tempo an execution context where you say which variables are static, and if they are static, what value they actually have, and which variables are dynamic in the sense that it changes per call to the function. So in this sort of simple example here, we would say that our R, X, and Y are dynamic. So for any call to this function, they're going to change. Bar N here is static for a given field. So we tell Tempo that for a particular field, our n was 6 for this case, I guess, and it spits out a specialized function. And for this particular example, there's nothing clever about that. That's pretty straightforward. But you can imagine things get a little bit more complicated. So this is a function that shifts your field element left by a distance d. Again, nothing really complicated about this, except that this time we're specialising two things at once. We give it the static value of n and the static value of d, and it produces us a function that does the same sort of thing. So it doesn't look very pretty, but essentially this is giving you a specialised shifting function for the shift distance of 1 and for n of 6. What I actually wanted to do on here was put the reduction function in, because that's at least a little bit more impressive, but it wouldn't really fit on the slide, so I didn't bother. Anyway, the sort of point about this is that when you actually do the timings of the Tempo version versus the hand-specialized version, the tempo version does just as well. In fact, it does a little bit better, because whereas I couldn't be bothered to unroll one of the loops in the reduction function, tempo could be bothered to do that because it's a program and not a DAM. So you get a sort of a little bit of an improvement even still over that. Plus, you get some advantage because once it's done all this specialization, suddenly the C compiler itself can do a better job of compiling the C code down to the executable. So, you know, all in all, this seems like a good idea. We've no longer got any of the problems associated with doing this by hand. We haven't got the labor, we haven't got the error. We can kind of tweak what tempo does to suit our platform. This just seems a good idea. I should say that, well, we chose the smallest, we chose this particular field rather, well, firstly because I couldn't get all the others on the slide, but, you know, this is going to be the thing that exacerbates the problem the most. The smaller the field, the bigger the cost of these fixed overheads becomes. So I suppose this is the sort of best or worst case, or most cheating case, I suppose you could say. But yeah, you get a similar sort of trends with different field sizes. So this is the result for binary fields. What we really want to do is extend this now to a system which will produce a specialized implementations of prime field arithmetic, but tempo won't deal with inline assembly language. So this becomes a slightly tricky thing to do, just because that's what you want to use some assembly language in your prime field arithmetic. So we're working on a system to do that. But I think, you know, generally speaking, this is a technique that should work on most field arithmetic. So once you've got your field arithmetic, the next task is to implement some curve arithmetic on top of that. And you can imagine a sort of an ideal method, in a sense, to do this. You take your favourite elliptic curve book. We're in Canada, so my favourite elliptic curve book is The Guide to Elliptic Curves at Crittolfi. Nigel's at the back of the room sharpening his knives for me because of that, but there we are. You look up your formula for your curve arithmetic. And, you know, in theory, you should just be able to type this in, right? You shouldn't have to kind of manipulate the formulas in too much to actually get a reasonable executable. You type the formulas in, you should be able to compile them and execute them and be reasonably confident that you're getting a good result in some way, functionally and in terms of performance. So you can sort of start approaching this with writing a cow program. So this is a doubling function that I copied out of that book, and what I've done is pretty much just type in the formulas as is. I haven't decomposed these down at all into what you might normally write. So normally you sort of write some things down in what looks like a kind of pseudo assembly language, right? You have to decompose all of these formula into sort of three address codes where you've got one target, two operands, and an operation, rather than actually writing out the formula. So my claim is, this is kind of more expressive. This is closer to the maths you want to implement. So in some sense, because it's a more natural way of writing the program, you should have less errors and be more productive, if you can translate this into something that equates to what you would do by hand in terms of the performance. But of course, compilers are good at doing this. If you were to replace these GF2 to the N types with integers and type this in as a C program-ish, then you'd expect the compiler to do a pretty good job of actually compiling that into something efficient. So we can pretty much just use standard compiler techniques to start translating this. So our front end of the compiler parses the program, turns it into some sort of syntax tree, translate that into an intermediate code, and then we can start applying standard textbook optimizations to our intermediate code. So we can start using strength reduction, for example, techniques to translate our power ins by small constants into an addition chain. So wherever I've got this power in by small constant 4, I can translate that into two squarings. This is strength reduction in the sense that hopefully my squarings are more efficient than doing a power in by 4, right? A general power in by 4. So, yep, this is easy. We can start applying common sub-expression elimination. This is another textbook optimization that your C compiler does all the time with programs that use types it knows about. So, for example, our x to the 4 here, when we translate it into our squarings, it uses this x1 squared. Well, we've already computed x1 squared here, so our common sub-expression elimination will kind of use this result instead of recomputing it again. We don't have to do that by hand, going through the formula saying, right, I'm going to pick this thing, pick this lambda whatever out of here and use it again here, because I shouldn't have to, right? This is pretty easy. We can reduce the footprint of our program. We can take a fairly automatic approach to perform register allocation. This is a pretty, a problem ripe for automation. I shouldn't have to go through my program and allocate, I don't use these two things at the same time. I'll just share the variable for them, and suddenly the size of my program footprint is reduced. Register allocation is pretty much just an application of graph coloring. Basically, you construct a graph where your nodes in your graph are your symbols in your program, and you make an edge between the nodes in the graph where the live ranges of these symbols overlap somehow, and then you color that graph using register names as the colors, and that gives you a pretty good allocation. Mike Scott mentioned yesterday this idea of lazy or delayed reductions. Well, you can imagine, it's not really useful in this context, but you can imagine if you were implementing curve arithmetic over time fields, then it might be nice to kind of automatically do that as well. You shouldn't have to go through by hand and say, this is where I should insert my reductions. It should automatically actually put those in the right places, minimize the number of those that you actually do. So this can be done by you can use a simple form of range analysis to do this, but that's maybe making a bit of a bold claim. To actually do a really good job of this, you have to formulate it as a kind of optimization problem, really. But I think that's a talk for another day. Mike also mentioned the idea of, almost offhandedly actually, the idea of caches making a difference to performance. And my heart was warmed when he said this, because I had this idea a while back as well. So you've got to consider these two programs, these two meaningless programs, admittedly. And I've cheated. I make no apologies for the amount of cheating that's gone on here, because I've written two meaningless programs that are entirely suited to my purposes rather than doing anything useful. So the program on the left here, this function f, has got all the function calls and all the variable usages are very local. So all of my adds calls are in one block, all my multiplies in one block, the subtracts and the squares and so on, plus all my usages of these variables are all grouped together. So in the instruction and data caches, they're going to exhibit a high degree of locality. I'm going to be able to access my instructions, and they're going to, with a high probability, going to be there in the cache, and I'm quickly going to be able to access them rather than slowly. On the other side, I've done the exact opposite and tried to mix these up in a sort of worst case example. So if you do the timing for these, then function f is consistently going to be faster. So okay, you might argue that this isn't very much, 1 to 3% faster, but this is running on the same platform as I ran my field arithmetic on. This is on a Pentium 4 processor, I can't remember how fast, but these things have caches that are gigantic. Intel's policy in building instruction and data caches is bigger is better. So your Pentium caches are about the same size as your house probably, and use around about the same amount of power. So in some sense, this is the best case from the processor point of view. If you were to use an embedded processor with a smaller cache, you'd expect this problem to have a much more of an impact on how fast things go. Well, so I've claimed that EC code has got similar sequences. Clearly, they're not that similar to this in the sense they do something useful. But, when you start considering hyperelliptic curves, we did some implementation of torus-based cryptography. The sequences of operations that you get start to get quite big. So even though they might not be perfectly local like this, you can start to think about rearranging the code, the actual function calls automatically, so as to improve the instruction and the data locality. And all this is an application of what's called instruction scheduling in compiler terminology, and you just have some cost function, some heuristic that guides where you place each function call. So this again, you're only getting incremental improvements here, but you're not having to do any work, right? You type in the formula for your curve arithmetic, and this should be able to spit out something that gives you this incremental improvement for absolutely no cost. Okay, so this is what the compiler produced for the Dublin function that I typed in. This isn't—it's not very attractive, I suppose. But this, isn't, if you sort of ignore the underscores and funny variable names here, this isn't too far off what you would write by hand. I would claim. So the underscore underscore ident anon here is the return value: my x3, y3, z3, and yeah, all the other ones are just temporary variables. So implementing our Dublin function is, you know, we get some advantages by using our compiler techniques. The compiler's done all our optimization for us, and okay, you have to choose the right algorithms to start with and so on. But once you've done that, the actual generation of the code itself is, you know, you get a big helping hand. So you can think about trying to implement some other aspects of your ECC system using COW. This is a fairly naive point multiplication algorithm, and the point of this, bad pun. The idea of this really is that not to show that this is obviously it's not the best algorithm in the world, but the idea here is to show that the result really of marking up some of our symbols in the program with some extra information. So in this case, we've marked our scalar multiplier here, D, is marked up with this sort of keyword here, secret. So this is kind of trying to convey to the compiler that this value D is in some way secret, and that when it starts to generate the code or do some analysis, it should be regarded as such. You couldn't necessarily do this in a C-type language. Okay, you could use the pragma directive, but yeah, I'd claim this is a better way of doing things. So your normal double and add algorithm is insecure. This is sort of known to be insecure against SPA attacks, because if I was to profile the execution of this algorithm, I can spot the difference between double and add operations, and so I can recover D just by sort of spotting when the addition happens, because when it does happen, I know that particular bit is 1, and if it isn't, then it's 0. So because I know D is secret, I can sort of start to do some analysis on my program, or the control flow graph of my program, to try and work out when an unbalanced condition like that might happen. So, I mean, you're used to looking at, I suppose, point multiplication algorithms. You can imagine this happening in a more general context. If you're using if you're implementing some multi-party computation like the SIMAP guys, you might do some analysis and it doesn't look anything like this, but the similar sort of situation remains. If you've got a value that's secret, you're doing a condition based on that value, then you're potentially leaking some information. So we can use this so-called program counter model of Molnar and others. And the idea here is that the program counter model kind of enables you to spot places where you have an unbalanced branch based on this secret. So we can spot this in an automatic way, and from a naive point of view, we can start warning the programmer that their program might be insecure from the point of view of side channels. So again, I wouldn't want to claim this does anything particularly clever. This is very simple, but it's giving us something extra over what a normal compiler would do. Yeah, it's not going to solve your problems, and if you went to your boss and said, yeah, my program's secure because my compiler said so, you know, fair enough, that's up to you. But yeah, it's giving you some extra information and doing some extra work for you. So, well, you wouldn't go to your boss and say, my program's secure because my compiler said so, because how do you know that your compiler isn't doing something very stupid? How do you trust what your compiler is doing? And that's the sort of the third leg of this talk. So there's some nice previous examples about this sort of thing, the first of which is this paper by Dennis Ritchie about the original C compiler, where he describes this idea of a Trojan horse C compiler. So what he describes is a compiler that inserts Trojan horses into the programs that it compiles. So it compiles your program, and maybe at the start of the main function, it checks the arguments coming into the program, and if they are a particular combination, it does something bad. So maybe it deletes all your files, or maybe it runs a shell so that when it's executed as a as a sort of administrative user, then you can get a shell on the machine. So it's inserting things in the program that are somehow bad. And he had this kind of long discussion about, well, okay, when you use that C compiler to compile the compiler, then the Trojan horse kind of remains, and it's quite a nice paper, but a great example of this idea, because you don't check the source code for your compiler. Well, I don't anyway. Maybe you've got more time than I have. So how do you know it's doing the right thing? And then at Eurocrypt this year, David Nakash gave an even better illustration of this sort of problem. I really like this. So the idea, So I'm just going to describe it quickly. But the idea basically was that he was talking about a system on chip, essentially. So there was some components in the system that were connected by a bus, and the bus was encrypted, presumably so that you couldn't kind of probe it and discover what was being communicated. So they had their system on chip design, and they fed this design through the synthesis engine, which is just a compiler that, instead of producing a program, produces some logic, right? Some actual hardware, if you like. And the synthesis engine looked at the bus and said, well, I've got X coming in one end of the bus and X coming out the other end of the bus, and there's all this crap in between. Well, we don't need that, so it just forgot about it. So it kind of optimized away the encryption, if you like, which was fantastic. So apparently David Nakash had a big argument with the people that were kind of verifying the chip, saying, yes, the encryption is there, and they said, well, no, the encryption is not there, and it went back and forth. But yeah, the end product was that the compiler had sort of pulled the wool over his eyes and done something that it shouldn't have done. It was trying to be too clever, I suppose. So I got interested in what was happening, just in general, what other contexts would this happen in? And I struck on the idea a long time ago, and recently sort of did some experiments to prove it worked, this idea of dynamic compilation. So this is kind of vital in languages like Java, because Java is an interpreted language, or rather you compile it down to bytecodes which are interpreted by a virtual machine. The idea of dynamic compilation is that the virtual machine monitors your programs being run, and it tries to find these, or the places in the program that are executed the most often. These are called the hotspots, and then it runs an actual a sort of more aggressive compiler on these hotspots to try and really make these as fast as possible. And this kind of makes sense in a virtual machine context, because you compile your bytecode to the virtual machine so that it's portable, but you've no knowledge about what sort of platform the virtual machine's running on. So if the virtual machine finds that this hotspot is being used very often, maybe it compiles it into native code that runs directly on the target machine. This runs a lot faster, and you get some sort of performance improvement. But from a security point of view, the concept of running programs that you haven't written is maybe not such a great idea. This seems kind of tenuous. So the idea was to look what would happen when you feed in some side-channel secure elliptic curve code and run it on one of these dynamic compiling Java virtual machines. So, first of all, maybe I should just mention what about the actual side channel security here. So the idea is that this is what's called usually called indistinguishable operations. So we heard yesterday at the rump session briefly about this idea of side channel atomicity. The idea basically is that what I want to do is make the doubling look the same as an addition. So I split the addition into two different sections, and I pad it to some extent. These lambda perp things here denote sort of dummy operations that I've inserted. I rearrange the operations in some way, and suddenly I've got a doubling that looks the same as the addition step one, that looks the same as the addition step two. If you look through the operations that are going on, they're exactly the same. So I probably should mention this was taken by a paper at CHES 2002, these instructions. I'm afraid I've forgotten who the authors were. Hopefully they'll forgive me. In fact, we can do this automatically as well. So we can actually, if you feed in your point arithmetic in this kind of formula fashion, once it's decomposed into this, which looks a bit like the intermediate code that's inside the compiler, we can actually rearrange them ourselves, right? This is just another form of optimization. If you've got a cost function that says similar is good, dissimilar is bad, then you just sort of do this instruction scheduling and you can get similar results for free. But again, that's another talk. The end result is that instead of, when you do your SPA attack on this indistinguishable arithmetic, instead of being able to distinguish between the double and the add, you get this just sequence of X's here, which is your kind of atomic block, and you can't really tell when the add's done and when the double's done. So the kind of security of these things is a little bit in question, because you have to be very careful about how the field arithmetic is implemented. But you know, generally speaking, this is maybe a good first step to try and make things side channel secure. So we implemented this in Java, and we ran it on the IBM Jikes virtual machine, research virtual machine. So this is something that enables us to play about with how the virtual machine works and profile what's going on in quite fine detail. So when we actually disable our dynamic compilation, we get these timings on the right here. So give or take, these are sort of, you know, you can regard the differences here as noise. They're pretty much indistinguishable. Or you can have a reasonable confidence that they're doing the same thing each time. But when you turn the dynamic compilation on, these change quite a lot. So first of all, they're kind of skewed. So suddenly addition step one is a lot faster for some reason. You know, the dynamic compilation system is obviously going to start inlining some functions. It maybe it spotted some of these dummy operations are just not used, so it just discards them. You know, all sorts of things. I couldn't tell you exactly what's going to go on inside that compilation phase. I suppose you could look into it and find out exactly. But the bottom line is our dynamic compilation has kind of skewed our originally indistinguishable operations. So that alone is quite a bad thing, because now I can probably distinguish between them again. And instead of getting these X's, I'm probably back to the case at the top here where I can you know, read them off one at a time. The second problem is that the timings in which these are optimized aren't the same. So what the dynamic compiler does is try to profile our program, and those functions that are executed more often are more likely to be aggressively recompiled. So we've got a timeline like this badly drawn diagram here. So we start off at T0 when we start running, and during this period here, we're using unoptimized methods, but both methods are unoptimized, so they're indistinguishable as they originally were. And of course, if we consider a random scalar multiplier, the double is going to be executed much more often than the addition functions, right? So at this point, the optimizer says, well, the double's been used quite a lot, well, I'm going to recompile that, and during this period now, I'm using the optimized double and the unoptimized addition methods. So clearly these are distinguishable. If you look back at the other slide, one took, you know, maybe half the time of the other. So, you know, in this period here, we're really screwed. And then at the end here, maybe the addition is now recompiled. You know, the difference between these is maybe not too much, but essentially there is a difference. At the end here, we're now using both optimized methods, and we're still kind of screwed because they're distinguishable because of the skewing in the timings. So the bottom line is that the dynamic compilation system has broken our side-channel secure code, i.e. you can't trust your compiler as far as you can throw it. So I'm kind of nervous about presenting this always, because there's people in the audience who are expert programmers, and they don't regard this sort of thing as a useful tool necessarily, because, you know, when I write field arithmetic, I don't use C, I write it in assembly language because I'm a real man. Or I don't use the comb method for field multiplication because I use XYZ method and that's rubbish. So, you know, it doesn't apply to me. But this isn't really about making a perfect system or a perfect compiler that could beat your expert programmer. It's about dealing with mundane things like maintainability and productivity and software engineering issues, really. So we can tolerate this worseness ratio if it gives us some advantage elsewhere. So all it is really is a means of giving out a helping hand. If I'm interested in rapidly prototyping some code, getting an idea about what reasonably accurately about how fast it goes, and then doing the rest by hand, you know, that's fair enough. I probably would be legitimately able to do that faster than if I did the whole thing by hand to start with. So it's not about making something that can beat Dan Bernstein. It's about transferring the knowledge of the cryptographic community into the sort of engineering community, I suppose you could say. ECC has been demystified enough that it's not necessarily experts in cryptography that implement ECC anymore, it's the likes of me, basically. So it isn't necessarily realistic for me to keep up. Well, I suppose it is my job, I think, so I maybe shouldn't say that. But in general, if you aren't a company that's well off enough to hire cryptographic professionals, then it's not really necessarily realistic to expect your engineers to keep up with everything that goes on in academia. So we'd like to transfer that knowledge into automated tools. So really, I've just tried to pick and choose some problems I was interested in. I think there's some bigger challenges, one of which is development of a unified language. There's some great projects going on. The two I listed at the start of the talk, are by no means the only ones out there. There's lots of different projects with different goals, and it would seem a shame that if we had lots of different languages, it would make sense if everyone was working with a similar language, and then they applied their analysis and transformation and optimization techniques to programs written in that one language, and then everyone can get the benefits, right? That would seem like a reasonable course of events. But of course, whenever you start talking about which is the best language, people start getting upset, and I'd say this is a difficult thing to solve from a political point of view rather than a technical point of view. More technical are the problems of, well, first of all, the compiler optimization ordering problem. Probably there's a better name for it than that, but it seems a bit harder in this context because some of the assumptions that we make are different. When a normal C compiler compiles programs and it has to spill a value to memory because it's run out of registers, that's not really that costly. If you've got a platform whereby you're holding a whole field element and you have to spill that to memory, suddenly that's a lot more costly. So some of the assumptions are different, and so maybe the order we apply optimizations and the sort of different ways they interact are different as well. We haven't got a good model for side channel security, so sort of detecting problems is difficult. If you haven't got a model to work with, this is a bit of a problem. So there's some good sort of starting points that Michele raised, and have got this very theoretical, I don't want to get into a Nigel discussion about what the relative merits of provable security, but their approach is that everything should be very rigorous. My opinion would be that if you've got a good model in the sense it enables you to have an idea about security without necessarily being exact, then that's better than having nothing at all. So the definition of good there is different, but I would say we haven't really got much of a model I can use at all. And finally, it seems difficult to prove the correctness from a security point of view of compilers. It's pretty difficult to prove the functional correctness of compilers, but when you throw in all these extra things into the mix, this seems a really a tough thing. I don't even know how to approach that, really. Okay, that's it. It is, yeah. I wouldn't want to claim that it's anything other than the prototype at the moment, to be honest with you, but we don't have anyone working on this full time. It's just something that, if we've got an idea, we try and hack something up to experiment with it. We'd really like any input. We've got plenty of ideas. We're really lacking manpower to follow through on those is the truth of it. So I wouldn't want to imply that it's anything other than a prototype, but yeah, it's there and you can download it and have a play. No, it's just a get-out clause, so I don't have to look stupid. No, I mean, some of these things are, if you set an expert programmer to a task and you gave him enough time, it seems obvious that he should always be able to do a better job, I would say. But that's not, yeah. The increase in complexity of some of these things means maybe you just haven't got that time, or you don't want to spend. Maybe you spend it doing something else instead. We haven't, no. Or rather, we did. We implemented some. So, So in the context of producing these indistinguishable formula, a colleague of mine in a university in Portugal implemented an optimization algorithm whereby you feed in the formula and it produces you these indistinguishable formula. And we did that for the hyperelliptic case. I can't remember what formulas he used, but yeah. But from a performance point of view, no, we haven't really tested that out.